Texas is a state of mind. Texas is an obsession. Above all, Texas is a nation in every sense of the word. But I think it is more than that. It is a mystique closely approximating a religion. And this is true to the extent that people either passionately love Texas or passionately hate it and, as in other religions, few people dare to inspect it for fear of losing their bearings in mystery and paradox. Californian John Steinbeck wrote that after driving through the Lone Star State in 1960. He was caught off guard by our unique Texan-ness, and that feeling hasn't gone away for many outside observers. Recently, another Californian living in Houston wondered in a lengthy New York Times column, who are these people, these Texans? What do they tell us about America? What to make of a state that is so focused on itself? I wrestle with these questions all the time, he said. Well, we don't have all the answers, but we do know there is something unique about who we are, and we're not afraid to show it off. I'm Charlie Scudder, and welcome to Texana, a podcast of Lone Star stories from the Dallas Morning News. We'll hope to answer some of these questions with stories from the Panhandle to the Gulf Coast, from the Piney Woods to Big Bend. We'll talk about Blue Bonnets, breakfast tacos, and Buc-ee's. We'll have stories from game stands on Friday night and church pews on Sunday morning. This is not a news podcast, but we'll focus on a few stories each episode that tell a little bit about what Texas is, who her people are, and what we aim to be. This is a pop-up podcast, meaning we won't be here every day or every week, but we'll be bringing you stories whenever possible. So subscribe on iTunes or go to dallasnews.com to make sure you don't miss an episode. As Texans, we flirt with duality all the time. People say Texans are just cowboys, but more of us are tech entrepreneurs and aerospace engineers today. People say Dallas is all money, but nearly one in five Dallasites live in poverty. Some of these stereotypes can grate, but we still cling to others, cultural heroes like Willie Nelson and the enduring legend of J.R. Ewing. Look no further than one Texas town to see that conflicting identity in action. This small town with brick-lined streets and empty storefronts is finding new life as a budding artist community. No, we're not talking about Marfa, but recent changes in Corsicana, about 50 minutes southeast of Dallas, have people wondering, is the Navarro County home of Collins Street Bakery and Wolf Brand Chili the new Marfa? Arts and culture editor Christopher Wynn and I have been working on a project called The Corsicana Diaries, which ran in the news in June. Recently, he sat down with some of the artists working in Corsicana.
With his boyish face, polite manners, and preppy topsiders, Kyle Hobratchka does not look like your typical craftsman and artist. He picked up a painting degree in 2011 from Southern Methodist University, and about a year later, he did something really crazy. Hobratchka bought a building. More specifically, he purchased a reasonably priced former Oddfellows Club building, circa 1898, in downtown Corsicana. He was 23. He had never owned property before. For the past 4 years, Hobratchka has been working to restore and renovate the classically three-story brick edifice into an artist residency. He's had help and sweat equity from several artist friends, including co-founders Travis Lamoff and Kieran Laughlin. The group calls their unlikely residency program 100 West. The name is a nod to the address at 100 West 3rd Avenue.
Hi, I'm Kyle Hobratch. I'm 27 and I'm an artist working between Dallas and Corsicana. Corsicana was a place I'd never been to before or heard of until a woman taking my printmaking class told me about a friend selling a place an hour south of Dallas that was an artist's dream space. And at that time, I had been looking for a wood shop. I had graduated from SMU not long ago, and this was 4 years ago, maybe almost 4.5 years ago.
I'm Kieran Laughlin. I'm 28 years old, almost 29. I'm an artist, and I teach at the University of Nebraska. Yeah, Kyle sent me an email with images, I guess he took on his phone, and the place just looked derelict, but the space was huge, completely open, and the first thing I remember was the patina of every single surface, the walls, the way the plaster had eroded over time, but I guess some
the enamel paint was still sticking there. And the windows are like these jumbo sized windows. They're like 5 foot by 9 foot windows. The light is incredible.
It was like borderline haunted, very damp. There were leaks from the roof. I think we showed up there for the first time after it had rained a lot. Just like opening that wardrobe, line was in the wardrobe, stepping into this place that is so foreign. I mean, really, it felt so foreign. You would traipse through and through and through, and it just seemed like it never ended. And Travis came down.
My name is Travis Lamoth. I'm 28. I'm a designer. I work at Barry Whistler Gallery, and I teach sculpture at SMU. Yeah, I was one of those early people. Kyle and I had just met. I was coming in for grad school, and he was leaving undergrad, and we were the only people working in the shop in the summer.
Right.
And Kyle was like, hey, you got to come down and see this crazy building. You know, and I guess as sculptors, sort of like space is a material in a way. So for some reason, I don't know if a lot of people are like, yeah, I want to look at a thing. It's like, oh, it's like an hour away. We'll go check it out. I went. We were just peeking in the windows at that time. I didn't even think you told me until we got down there that you had bought it.
I had to look it up on a map and see where it was. And I called up a realtor to go check it out. And went down with a couple friends. And I think at 15, 20 miles in, we called the realtor to say, we're still not seeing the signs for Corsicana. She's like, you got to keep driving. Well, I mean, it just seemed so far removed and unrealistic, but this place was like unlike anything I'd ever seen before. It had, I think, as most places we go into were people were living in them, or they're using them, or they're doing something with them. This one was just sitting for a couple of years. It had a stillness to it, and really hadn't been changed since the 1890s. One coat of paint, relics lying around. It's as if, they left it just 20 years after they made it and never returned. You know, some paper on the floor just scattered around. So I went back successively with a new friend every time to show this escape, this wonder, what could we do there? It was way more space than I needed for any wood shop.
When did you discover that there was a history in the building associated with the KKK?
Whoa. Okay, so this news didn't take long to discover, the news surrounding KKK activity in the building. I don't think we ever volunteered ourselves to hear it. It just came from anybody driving past. We'd be around, coming in and out of the building. People hadn't seen much activity in the building for a few years, so they would slow down, roll down their window, chat you up a little bit, and then there would always be this moment. I mean, it was common. Travis, I'm sure, experienced this too with people, where they'd say, well, didn't you know? And then there's like this pause. It's, know what? Oh, well, know that the KKK met up there. And they'd always whisper it or say, a little softer. And you got to the point, it's like, yeah, we know. And so sure, I mean, there's a soiled history to that building, but it doesn't have a bad energy to it, I don't think, when you walk in. I mean, it feels reclaimed.
Sort of like the Oddfellows had it for enough time to outweigh that.
Right.
I think we stay honest to that part of the history well enough.
Tell me about, now you've got the building, you've got it basically in shape. When do you start having artists come into the building? And I'm curious what the townspeople are thinking and feeling and how they're reacting to having you guys suddenly in their midst.
Maybe it's worth saying that, or admitting that, when we got this building, the thought was this building could be anywhere, it's worth driving to. We're going down for the building, maybe not so much for the town. At first glance, the town, Corsicana, to me, didn't appear like art center. I was a naive, like, just post-grad art student. who, you know, had a lot of assumptions about what an art scene or art making space would look like. And it wasn't Corsicana. And, but it really didn't take long to find out that all the shopkeepers around the building and locals who would drop by and check on the progress ended up becoming just, you know, the best social network we could have asked for down there. And it's so encouraging and interested, whether they have a background in art or not. They're just very receptive to it, and it's blown me away how important that's been and how helpful it has been and how nice it has been to share this place with all kinds of people that we would have probably not met in Dallas. So the town is small. You know, we're in a little historic downtown, and there's several neighborhoods around it, and, you know, our social base down there is far more varied than it would ever be here in Dallas. I mean, we've got, you know, friends in their 80s who will have us over for dinner, and, you know, they're all interested to meet these residents. Just this last year, we put out a call for applicants to apply to this program, and selected 15 to come between January and May of this year, 2016. And out of those, I think only one or two are actually from Texas. The rest of the residents came from outside the state or outside the country. And they were coming, I think, because a lot of them had this intrigue about Texas. Texas has a certain mystique to it. They wanted to know if it was like the movies. I mean, I don't know if we had to perform any or not to prove to them that it is or it isn't. But, I mean, it was at least a card in our favor to pull some people out to see Texas. And so I think the locals recognize that, and if they've got a ranch, you know, come out, see our ranch, let's have a cookout. Or, hey, I've got a place in Santa Fe, you know, I got to go out there anyway. Why don't you come out with me, and we'll do a road trip through the West, see Santa Fe. That happened with one of our last residents, and a great gentleman in his 80s, Joe Brooks, who took one of our residents from Cornwall, UK, out to Santa Fe for several days. So it's taken a lot of the pressure off of Travis and me and other friends who've been a part of 100 West to host these residents. And I think that the communities assumed that role as well, just as much, you know, if not more. So it's gotten to the point where there's rarely a night that goes by where there's not some invitation for some resident to go visit with somebody, or somebody wants to come have a studio visit. The conversation is deep.
So last question, is Corsicana the new Marfa?
No.
And why?
I think Marfa offers a lot for artists and for the public that's not making art. They've got programming. They've got, they can pull out a lot of stops. Right, I think we're in Corsicana now, just quietly going about our business, making work, and with no aspirations to achieve, you know, a title like Marfa. I think we found a quiet place to go and make work and see it installed and realize spaces. I don't know. That's a because Marfa comes with a lot of other meanings and words, you know. It's a loaded name.
I would add to that Marfa's very good at being Marfa because it's an honest place, and it grew out of its own, you know, need in a way.
And in that way, I think we see a good model.
Yeah, we see a good model for that, but it means that we're staying loyal to something that's both Corsicana-based and Oddfellows-based, 100 West, this program-based. So staying loyal to that should indefinitely produce something that is equally unique, but certainly not that.
Yeah, we don't have the landscape, you know, we have a building.
Now I ain't got nobody, and there's nobody cares for me. 'Cause I am saying
take a chance with me.
That was the voice of Hattie Ellis. In the early 1930s, she was a bootlegger in Wild and Woolly Dallas. In 1933, she got in a fight with another woman and shot her twice, once in the stomach and once in the back. The judge sentenced her to 30 years. It would have been less, but she sassed the judge in the courtroom. Ellis's story is highlighted in a new book about the musical history of Texas prisons. With me now is Caroline Nagy. Her new book is Texas Jailhouse Music, A Prison Band History. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, my pleasure. How are you?
I'm doing well. I want to talk about this new book. I know it focuses on a radio program, 30 Minutes Behind the Walls from WBAP, which fit into a tradition of barn dance radio shows, right? Can you tell us a little bit about it? How popular was this program? What was its format? That sort of thing.
Sure. Well, it started on March 24th, 1938. That was the inaugural show. That's, you know, really much in the era between the Great Depression and the New Deal and then going into World War II. So we had an audience of rabid radio listeners that were looking for something new and exciting and also something that sort of rang true with their everyday lives. I would say that as far as the radio show's format, there was a similarity to barn dance radio in the fact that they played a lot of barn dance type favorites like country music songs and western and fiddle songs, but it was also part of a partially would be considered a vaudevillian or almost like a amateur hour type radio show. They had an announcer. It was sort of a combination of that as well as a public relations show, because they also on the show the format was the format worked where an announcer would. Announcer with WBAP in Fort Worth, which is a clear channel radio station, would announce the inmates. Then there would be an inmate announcer who would in turn announce the bands as they came on the air with a brief description before, and then they would perform. It was an integrated radio show. There were bands formed of all races and genders, male, female, African American, Mexican or Latin. They even played Hawaiian songs.
And I know in the book, it's full of these great anecdotes and inmate profiles. One that jumped out at me was Ledbetter. And you mentioned that he almost tried to sing his way into a pardon by writing a song for the governor of Texas.
Yes.
Can you tell us?
And I do think that was actually a successful. I mean, he didn't. His music prowess was well-known in the prison system, and, at the time, even though it was a brutal system for those inmates who were favored, especially those with talents that could entertain the prison staff and their friends or whatever, they would call upon the services of these inmates to do so, and Hootie Ledbetter, or better known as Leadbelly, was a really astute fellow. He knew how to play on people. I think that's one of the most talent, you know, one of the most identifiable aspects of his music. He really knew how, he knew people, and he knew how to work it to his advantage when he was in a tough situation. So he chose an opportunity and used that opportunity to create his song in the presence of, you know, the people who had the power, and made it seem like it was, you know, spontaneous, which was really clever. And I think that he worked really hard to obtain that in that aspect. And he subsequently was given his freedom, although the world didn't discover his music until John Avery Lomax came through Angola prison when he was there a few years later.
Right.
You know, he let loose here, but then he got back into some trouble in the later 30s and mid-30s, and Lomax found him in Angola and recorded them at that time.
Gotcha. And you talked about another one of those Lomax recordings of Hattie Ellis, whose voice you compared to Billie Holiday. And I want to talk about kind of some of the cultural exchanges that could have been happening behind bars, because you mentioned she sang a jazz song in the style of Western swing king Bob Wills.
I do think so, yeah.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, this is my assessment for the book.
Sure.
What I did was I listened to song I Ain't Got Nobody. First of all, the fact that Lomax recorded that, I think, was a really impressive thing, because John Avery Lomax and his son Alan, they went through the prisons looking for African American folk songs, because they had a mission. They wanted to find songs that were the most archaic, primal forms of the music, and they really wanted to exclude anything modern or jazz. Well, I Ain't Got Nobody is a popular jazz song from that era and
right.
from the 20s. So there were a number of different artists that had actually already recorded that song by the time that they came through in 1939 to record Hattie Ellis. It was May of 39. And she was already popular on the radio show, and perhaps they pushed her in front of the Lomaxes, but she definitely was an amazing singer. There are recordings of her doing this song. So I listened to the recordings, and I listened to the versions from some of the other artists who had recorded by 1939 that same version. And the people who I found her closest resemblance, her stylistic version of it closely most resembling what would be Bob Wills. So I realized, and I also realized that she no doubt had heard a lot of these jazz artists, but the Bob Wills aspect and influence may have come out in part because she was performing that song in the recording with a white inmate. His name was Jack Ramsey. That was one of the few white inmates that the Lomaxes ever recorded. And the only one that I found, actually. And I think that she really got it from him, from maybe the stringsters. They would perform that song, and they might have been more familiar with the Bob Wills version. And This Is Texas, perhaps, that was the version that she had to learn from. But she had this style that sort of melded the two cultures, which I thought was really interesting. She did not sound like Louis Armstrong, and she didn't sound, like some of the others. She sounded the most, and with the lyrics and with her vocal style, the most like Bob Wills. So I thought that was a really neat sort of assimilation of two different aspects, of two different racial aspects of the same type of song.
Interesting. So what made audiences connect with this kind of country music, and why did Prisoners perform it?
Well, the Prisoners, they performed, for the most part, they performed songs that were popular with the public.
Okay.
And people really did enjoy that. I think they played songs that were patriotic. They played popular Hawaiian-style tunes, songs that were sentimental, home sweet home-type songs, a lot of cowboy songs.
Mm-hmm.
And they really went for the popular tunes. I think partially that's a logistical reason, which is they're easy to learn, at least. They may have been a complex to learn, but they were easier because there would be sheet music available, perhaps, that some of the more musical inmates could learn and inform and teach the other inmates. That's how they learned to play. Many of these people didn't play or perform before they went in. So that was really fascinating because they had to learn from the other inmates.
Oh, wow.
And I think that since sheet music was available and they had what was called a prison song library, and they had sheet music and songs in it, thousands and thousands of them, apparently, at one point. I had read an article about that. So I think that's where they pulled it. So sheet music was definitely helpful, and of course it was very prevalent in that time for people who are learning music. So they played songs that people wanted to hear, and I think that people wanted to hear, of course, there's the novelty, the curiosity, the incredible, compelling idea of hearing someone on the radio who's criminal case you might have read about in the newspapers couple of years prior. So there's this sort of fascination, I wouldn't say lurid, but kind of, you know. but also just the understanding and the realization that these were men and women that were not so far off from their own brother or sister or wife or mother. And they used the inmate interviews to sort of underscore that aspect of it.
Right.
So I think the inmates really wanted to provide that to the people, to help the people see them as human, and they really did. I mean, we're talking thousands of fan letters every week. First week, I think it was 3,000. It was 100,000 for one show at one point. We're talking about thousands. I mean, it's kind of crazy if you think about it.
That's a lot of prison mail.
Yep, so, exactly. And it wasn't just mail. There were gifts.
Oh wow!
There were gifts of mail, of money, of homemade items, even food, and at that time, you know, of course, they were better able to accept items like that.
Sure.
So
this
so,
wasn't
yeah,
just.
They were...
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm done. That's it.
Oh, I was going to say, so just this wasn't just a small group of avid listeners. This was a more widely popular thing. So groups like the Gory All-Girl String Band, excuse me, how recognizable would they have been in mainstream culture, at least in Texas?
Well, I think that, I mean, I wasn't there, obviously.
Sure, well, sure.
But I think that in that era of Texas, they had to have been very recognizable, not just because they were on the radio. The radio show was an integral part, first and foremost, because it aired from WBAP in Fort Worth, which was a clear channel radio station, had 50,000 watts, so people heard it in Canada and Mexico. Hmm. But on a local level, they also did a live floor show every week before the radio program. And they had hundreds of people arrive every week at the prison to go to line up at the prison gates to go into the auditorium to watch these inmates perform the songs that they would later perform on the radio. So they knew them. They learned their stories, and some of the more notable inmates may have had cases that were in the newspaper, as I had a couple cases of that, a couple situations like that in the book. And then on top of that, these inmates, they went out into the communities. They were out in Texas. They played the Shreveport Rodeo. They played the fiddle festivals in Athens and in Carthage. They would play public functions and fairs and state fairs. So they were out there, as well as being inside. So I think that on a national level, people would know them from the radio, but on a local level, they would know them even from seeing them in person any number of times.
Wow, that's impressive. So
yeah,
what can we learn from these musicians? Why do their stories matter today?
Well, there's a couple different reasons. I think that there's still, you know, a sort of lurid fascination. When you think of the Texas prison system, you kind of, you know, think about a large-scale, systematic sort of depersonalization of, well, the inmate experience, for lack of a better phrase. You know, while things were brutal back in the day, they were very personally brutal, I think, for many of the inmates. There was also a feeling of hope and a real possibility of rehabilitation. And I think some of that's been lost in recent decades. And I think that this book will sort of help highlight how things used to be, and perhaps we can, without bringing back that brutality, perhaps we can bring back some of that spirit of rehabilitation. I think that... And I also know that this history doesn't happen just in Texas. It's in many states. And there are some state prison systems who are using prison bands, music programs, as part of their inmate rehabilitation. But there are not very many, and certainly not Texas at this time, although it did persist for many decades. So I really think, and we all know, I think, and we all feel that music is a very important feeling, a very important part of feeling alive. And if you're in a situation like a prison, you don't get to feel like that. On top of that, it's so incredibly helpful for people in a group setting to feel a sense of accomplishment, learning songs, performing music, to work with a team, as a team, with a group, and to create something that's just positive simply for itself.
Caroline Nagy's new book is Texas Jailhouse Music, A Prison Band History. Caroline, thanks for joining us.
No problem. Thank you.
Lord Jesus will be calling on that great day. Lord Jesus will be calling on that great day. Lord Jesus will be calling on that great day.
I hope y'all enjoyed this inaugural episode of Texana. Make sure to subscribe on iTunes or DallasNews.com so you don't miss an episode. You can follow me on Twitter at CScudder, that's CScudder. Follow Christopher Wynn at Christopher Wynn, CHRISTOPHERWYNN. Learn more about 100 West at 100westcorsicana.com. Find Caroline Nagy's new book, Texas Jailhouse Music, in stores and online at Amazon.com. The 1939 recordings were provided by the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress. Until next time, happy trails, and thank you for joining us with Texana.